You're listening to KGPR, Great Falls at 89.9 FM, public radio for North Central Montana. And here in the studio with me is music director and conductor of the Great Falls Symphony, Grant Harville. Welcome back.
Thank you, Matt. Good to be here.
And April is already here, and so is spring. But there's something special coming up this month besides Easter, but something more famous. Can you tell us what that may be?
Sure. I don't know if it's more famous than Easter exactly, but certainly one of the most famous orchestral compositions ever composed, and that's Messiah by George Frideric Handel. Often done at Christmas, but it originated as an Easter piece, as a springtime piece, premiered in April in 1742. And so we are honoring that tradition this year by having it as our April program.
Yeah, that's perfect, especially since it's kind of got spring-like qualities, and it's perfect for this type of, along the same vein as Easter.
Sure. You know, it's, I'm sure we'll get into more detail, but it's basically in three parts. The first part is the Christmas part, and then you have the Easter part, and then you have the sort of post-Easter part at the end. A lot of the music, you know, the Hallelujah Chorus being the famous one, is actually, that's an Easter, that's a resurrection onto the next coming of Jesus kind of sentiment, which is not really a Christmas sentiment. It's definitely a post-Christmas sentiment. So it certainly makes sense for this time of year, but it's just a sort of joyful celebration, a joyful way of bringing people together, and it's brought people together now for almost 300 years. So it felt like a good way to culminate the season.
Especially since it's a very religious time of year with Easter and of course I think we just left the season of Lent and entering to Palm Sunday and then on towards the Easter holiday.
Yeah, and you know, it's one of those pieces that lots of people of lots of different faiths have found a lot of meaning and beauty in, and the Christian sentiment is strong in it, and you know, its origins, again, we can get into more detail, actually have charitable associations. When Handel was making his trip over to Dublin, a big reason he made that trip was as a kind of fundraising event for various causes that were happening.
And can you tell us more about about the Messiah piece? Like, what motivated him to write the piece and why has become such a iconic staple as far as Easter and choral cantatas in general?
Yeah, well, you know, what motivated him to write it and why it became so popular are two interesting and pretty kind of different questions. So, but Handel was German. He's born in 1685, famously the same year as Bach, and sort of part of this Bach-Handel-Telemann generation. And unlike Bach, who stayed very, very close to home, Handel traveled, went to Italy, and then settled in London in the 17-teens. I guess he would have been almost 30 at that point. And it really worked out for him to be a kind of a favorable situation for a composer making a living for a couple of reasons. One being that London was a very strong commercial center. So you had a lot of people with money to burn, looking to buy tickets to stuff, and Handel was there ready to write the music for them to buy tickets for things. Really cut his teeth with Italian opera. So these were Italian language operas where they would bring in singers from Italy, and the London audiences would go for those. But the other part that was really in his favor was that in 1714, there's a new king, King George I, who was, like Handel, was a sort of a German import. And so Handel got in good with the royal family and became sort of a de facto Kapellmeister, that is, the sort of chief musician for the King of England, and so wrote a lot of royal music, if you know, things like the water music and music for the fireworks and coronation anthems and things like that. All of these pieces that were sort of ceremonial or works written for specific events for the royal family, Handel was the one writing a lot of that stuff. So on the one hand, he had all this steady sort of pension. This he was sort of on retainer with the royals. And then on the other hand, he had ways of making money with the ticket-buying public.
Wow.
And between those two things, he eventually settled in very well into London life. He actually spent the last 30-some years living in the same house, which is sort of the opposite of what Mozart did when he got to Vienna, which is essentially move, it seems like, every 6 months or something like that. But Handel settled in, became an institution in London musical life, cultural life, and became essentially the most sort of celebrated and successful composers for, in particular, that London crowd of his day. He did have some misses, as anyone would if you write dozens of operas and things like that. And in the late 1730s, early 1740s, he hits not exactly a dry spell, but he has a couple pieces that don't go as well as he might have hoped. And so he gets this invitation from Dublin, from the Duke, and basically to come over and do a concert series. And this is, as I mentioned before, it's something that's also inspired by some charitable groups who are looking, to put on benefit concerts, basically. So Handel spends most of a good chunk of 1741 and 1742 in Dublin, makes the 14-hour trip over to across the Irish Sea and over to Dublin, and puts on this concert series. And so you asked why did this happen? Well, first of all, as always, it was to make money. Handel was in charge of a lot of his own entrepreneurship, printing out and selling tickets and advertising and things like that. He would have been in charge of the kind of impresario aspect of a lot of his performances, certainly including this particular concert series, which sold very well. It was a subscription thing, and it apparently sold out. I think 600 folks were allowed, and that was the capacity of the hall. There's a famous story about Messiah in particular where the women are told not to wear their hoops in their hoop skirts, and the men are told not to bring their swords.
Oh, wow.
not because there was any threat of violence, but swords were sort of a kind of fashion accessory at the time.
Okay.
So swords and hoops would have just gotten in everybody's way, and they wanted to make sure they filled the hall as tightly as they could. And so there, again, various sort of charitable inspirations were the other part of it, and not just making money for Handel himself, but making money for these other causes. So they had some sort of famine situations prior to this point. Messiah itself, that concert was, I believe, for both to benefit prisoners and invalids, people at a hospital who were sick at a hospital. So that was the kind of immediate charitable inspiration for the Messiah performance in particular. So 1742 then is when Messiah is premiered. Again, packed house. The nice thing about oratorio, which is different from opera in that it tends to have, I mean, technically it should always have a religious theme. Its origins go back to a kind of chapel in Italy in the 1500s. It's born out of that church situation, not staged. But in England, oratorio was English language. And unlike the Italian operas that Handel was writing, right? So Handel, of course, was a native German speaker, which meant that he spent the vast majority of his career never writing in his native language. He was either switching from Italy or into English or back.
So he was multilingual.
Yeah, although apparently, you know, how many decades does it take to really become fluent in English? Apparently it's more than the almost four that Handel required. He still apparently had an accent to the end of his life. And there are some things in Messiah where some of the word stress is a little bit strange, and you don't know if that's some of that's certainly because they pronounced English in ways that we don't pronounce English anymore, but some of it's because you know, it wouldn't have immediately hit his ears the same way it would have hit a native English speaker. But the nice thing about writing oratorio in English is that you can use local talent. You weren't importing famous Italian opera stars and, you know, having to ship them over and deal with all that nonsense. You could use the local singers. So soloists were either Irish or English for those first performances. And, you know, just taken from the local pool. And, and yeah, as I say, it wasn't something where they brought in the brightest stars of European culture for that. They could just, you know, in English, they could just use those local folks. So, so yeah, the first performance is, I guess, April 13th is when it goes down. And it ends up being, as I say, as best we can tell, a really successful event. The reception is good. It's sold out. This wasn't really a completely open to the public kind of thing. As I say, it was a subscription thing. So it would have been not quite invitation only, but it definitely would have been targeted towards the upper crust. These are, you know, either private rich people or noble-ish people who, again, are there to support this charitable cause and to hear some great Handel. As I say, you know, prior to Handel's trip to Ireland, it's, again, it's not fair to say that things were going badly for him at all, but, you know, no matter how great somebody is, when you've been hearing his stuff for 30 years, you know, it's hard to impress that same audience in quite the same way for decades and decades. So I think what really helped give it that good initial reception is that by coming to Ireland, coming to Dublin, where Handel's music was not completely unknown, but it would have been a really unfamiliar thing relatively. And, you know, you could get people coming in and saying, yes, we get to hear Handel live for the first time, right? It's a new thing for them, a new kind of experience. And easier to generate excitement in that situation. So Handel had a really positive experience there, debated staying longer, actually, but ended up coming back back to London and living out the rest of his days there. Ends up going blind early in the 1750s, as Bach did as well, although that was from botched surgeries going on in Bach's case too. But yeah, and staying in the same house that he'd lived in since 1723. The, you know, the second question about why is this music so popular? You know, how did it enter the canon, so to speak, is a really interesting one. It didn't do so immediately. There were some London performances that happened after the Dublin one. And they were fine, but it wasn't, there was no indication that this was going to be sort of permanent fixture for centuries to come. And in some ways, the reason for that is simply that it kind of didn't exist. There was no such thing as a piece that would stay in the repertoire for hundreds of years. So the Messiah almost sort of invents that kind of phenomenon. And that's something we're really used to right now, you know, listening to music of other times, of previous times. We do that all the time. And not just in classical music, right? You know, people still listen to the Beatles and Louis Armstrong and things like that. And, you know, we're perfectly happy to listen to music that's not of our time in a way that kind of didn't happen back in Handel's day. And so Messiah, it's not like it stays permanently in the repertoire from 1742 on, but it's revived in, I guess, the 1780s. And basically it's from that point on that it never really leaves concert halls. And so so we're talking about not quite 250 years of near permanent performances at this point.
So it still resonates to this day as these pieces are forever timeless.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a great quote by Dave Grohl, the Nirvana Foo Fighters
guy. Fighters.
Yeah, yeah, who's talking about, you know, you know, what's so great about the experience of being on stage for a big audience? And he says, you can sing something to a crowd of 80,000 people and they'll sing it back to you for 80,000 different reasons. And that's, you know, when we're talking about the sort of religious aspect of the work, which is, of course, infused throughout it, you know, there are plenty of non-Christians who really find something inspiring about the piece. And, you know, for 250 years, you know, going through all these cultural changes and geographic changes, people have found things to respond to inspire them and to respond to in it. You know, why this piece? You know, what was special about Messiah compared to? There's plenty of other great pieces out there. You know, lots of great music in the world. So, why did this one sort of become the first to actually become a canonic piece that stayed in the repertoire well after its origin? And you know, there are a few reasons I think for that. One is that it's actually really good. You know, lots of great tunes, lots of fun, exciting, dramatic sections. I'm sure we can talk about a few of those in more specific detail, but. You know, the Hallelujah Chorus is a really good time. You know, that that kind of thing does matter. But other things that I think really helped it along were that it's an oratorio, which means that it's less focused on the star power of the soloists than an opera would be.
Okay.
The solos are great and they're important. But this is a piece which where a lot of the drama and excitement and fun goes into the chorus parts itself. And chorus is by definition a kind of popular activity. You need a lot of people in the same room to do it. And so if you can get the choir to love something, that means you're getting a lot of people all at once to love something. And you know, in Britain, this has a very strong choral tradition. So if something can get a foothold there, then it's going to spread like wildfire there. And so something that, you know, choral music was becomes kind of this institution in Britain. So these kinds of pieces, these oratorio pieces, can spread and get a foothold in a way that might not have happened in some other countries. The choir, the choral parts themselves are challenging without being overwhelming,
especially like the tonalities when they have to like sing like not like just one note but a series of notes like da 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 da.
Yeah, so
without trying to take a breath somewhere in between.
And it's, you know, it sort of hits this sweet spot where it's not too easy to be boring, but it's not too difficult to be unsingable by most choirs. Most choirs with a reasonable amount of training can sing this piece. Some will do it better than others, of course, but it's one that's within the reach of a lot of choirs. You know, there's almost no division beyond the four standard parts, soprano, alto, tenor, bass. You get occasional three-part soprano and alto, but and that makes a big difference, right? The more parts you divide it into, the more independence you need per person to do that. And so that, again, is another reason why it's, as a performance piece, it's accessible for, again, for most choirs. The solo parts are not the easiest things in the world, but they're not going to kill you. you know, this isn't like Verdi or something where you need like world-class soloists to do it.
Even Gilbert and Sullivan, they're known for their complexity and within their within their songs.
Yeah, you know, some of those you know, soprano arias that you find in Gilbert and Sullivan, if you don't look too closely, you will underestimate them in terms of the challenge. It's not quite the same level of difficulty. That, again, especially when you get into these sort of romantic era Verdi and Donizetti and things like that, where they're really showing off, again, this Italian star power is a lot of that. Messiah doesn't require Italian star power. You need great singers. You need people, of course, are going to do a really wonderful job. And that's not to say, again, that they sing themselves. There's their real challenges in, you know, the solo parts as well. But a higher number of people can take on those solos. And I think that kind of performance level accessibility is another reason why this piece gets done so much. The other part of it, quite simply, another practical issue is the orchestra is not very big. You know, if you're thinking like Berlioz Requiem, where you have offstage brass choirs and things like that. It's a lot of fun, but you need billions upon billions of people to do it, right? And, and the Handel, you know, the basic orchestra that Handel was writing for was strings, a keyboard player, bassoon, two oboes, two trumpets, timpani.
Wow.
That's something that a lot of people can find. Mm-hmm. And if you want to do something bigger, just because you feel like it, well, you've got the Mozart arrangement that Mozart did in the 1780s, which has trombones and sort of a full standard classical orchestra. You can do it that way as well. So, again, it's really easy to... Virtually every orchestra or choral ensemble can solve the practical problems of the piece. So that makes a big difference. You know, no matter mm-hmm. how much you like something, you know, if it has six oboe d'amores and, you know, a didgeridoo, you know, there are a lot of groups that aren't going to be able to play that piece just because they don't have the human beings who are capable of pulling it off. And Messiah is not one of those pieces. So I think those couple of things in particular are, again, they don't explain, but they at least, they're potential barriers that don't exist, right? So the performance parts of it are more straightforward than some other pieces. The music is so much fun and it's so good. And again, being a choral piece, choral has a kind of... sort of popular nature that is adaptable to a bunch of different situations. You know, it's a lot easier to start a choir than an orchestra just because you don't need people to buy their own trombone. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So as long as people have you know, vocal cords, they have the instrument necessary to be a choir member. And so that's why you tend to have more choirs, especially more volunteer choirs all over the place than you will find sort of volunteer orchestras. And the other thing, again, about choirs is that because it's not one and apart, you have sections of people all singing the same part, it lends itself to a variety of different sizes. So there are some famous performances in the 19th century of Messiah where they had literally like 10,000 singers on stage.
Wow.
I mean, that either sounded amazing or just awful. I have no idea which, but at the same time, if you want to do it with 20 singers, you absolutely could. And so again, it's this sort of practical issue of you can do it no matter what your choir is, you can probably do the piece, which again, that may seem trivial, but it's really not. Again, if you're talking about popularity of something, the more people who can do it, it really provides an opportunity for that.
And since this is such an iconic piece, especially with the Hallelujah Chorus that was used in a lot of media, it sounds like anything is possible on how it's sung, by whether it's like even like a small vocal ensemble to something massive, like you said, with 10,000 singers.
Yeah, you know, because the orchestra doesn't have to be huge, the choir doesn't have to be huge either. Mm-hmm. So
it won't be like, you know, Mahler or Wagner or anything like that. Yeah. Something, you know, huge and powerful enough to put people to the back of the auditorium practically.
Right. You know, it's not a sort of symphony of 1,000 kind of situation. Yeah. At least it doesn't need to be.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it has the kind of drama. You know, there's some purists who will object, of course, but the piece is dramatic and it does... sort of hit these emotional beats that if you want to go power on it, rather than sort of delicate, you can, you know, as I say, 10,000 seems like a bit much, but 200 is just fine. You know?
Oh yeah.
And so, you know, it won't, you know, there's a version of the piece that will sound great with that relies on sort of strength for its impact. And there's a version of it that will sound great that relies on sort of refinement as well.
What's really going to make this fun is it's going to be done by not only the Great Falls Symphony, but the Symphonic Choir, which is such a wonderful staple for not only the Great Falls Symphony, but for the Great Falls community itself.
Yeah, you know, our Symphonic Choir has existed almost as long as our symphony. It was... founded a year later, so the symphony in its current form started in 1959, and the Symphonic Choir came along the year after. So they are our partners in crime, and they always have been. Happy to have them. You know, the version we're doing, and when I say version, but we're not doing all of the piece. We're doing about, I'd say, 2/3 of it, and that's a COVID adaptation. We wanted to make sure that if we had to sneak it down into an intermissionless form, that we would be able to do it. So So we will have a symphonic choir. Of course, we'll have our orchestra. We're actually doing it with two soloists instead of the usual four. And they're both folks who are known to our community here. One is Stephanie Jennings, who will come in and do our soprano solo. She's been here before, and I've yet to meet her, but by all accounts, she's great and a great person to work with. And we'll have a tenor soloist as well. That's Jeffrey Kiddo, who's based out of Bozeman, and he's been here to sing with us before as well. So looking forward to working with both of them. But as I say, we'll do about 2/3 of the piece. So the soprano and tenor solo parts, as well as almost all of the chorus parts.
And it should be fun, especially trying to get people to sing Handel and to sing it well. And I know that you're also the choir director, right?
Yeah, I've been working with the choir. We actually started at the beginning of this year, back in September. We took a break to work on our holiday music, but yeah, we've had our Messiah scores out for a long time now, and yeah, it's been great to work with them. It's really starting to come together now, and I'm sure we'll do a great job. But you know, as I say, it's a really dramatic piece, and a lot of the drama is in the choral parts, and so they sort of have to act as very different characters in different situations. You know, some of the most famous choruses, they take on very different kinds of moods and attitudes. So if you think of something like For Unto Us a Child is Born, mm-hmm. right? Again, lovely melody. And but it has a kind of innocence to it. It's sort of a sort of happiness and a lightness to it, which mm-hmm. makes perfect sense when you're talking about, you know, a bouncing baby boy, right? Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. as that chorus moves on later, where you're talking about, and his name shall be called Wonderful and Counselor, the Mighty God, right? That's a very different image than a bouncing baby boy, right? And the attitude of the chorus has to change there. They're suddenly singing these Wonderful Counselor. It's a very kind of regal situation where they've very much switched to this kind of little kid to position of authority. Mm-hmm. And to get that difference, which is actually a pretty remarkable thing for Baroque music. Mm-hmm. Baroque music tends to sort of set a mood and stay there.
Mm-hmm.
So to get that kind of contrast within the space of one chorus is a pretty remarkable thing.
Going from innocent to very bold.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. And that's absolutely written into Handel's music, right? This sort of, again, this very light, For unto us a child is born. And you get these little dancing lines. And then suddenly all of that gets, again, sort of, transformed into these sort of fanfare-like passages where you're singing the Wonderful, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, where the character really changes. It's a very kind of accessible way of setting the text, right? It's not something where you have to have years of musicological training to understand. That kind of character comes through very immediately. There's a lovely section that starts the second part. Again, if the first section is the Christmas section, the second section is the Easter bit. And so there are three choruses right in a row, which are all connected. They each get into a different kind of mood that is sort of passion related. So we're talking about the, Christ's execution and what's the right word? Torture or punishment, whatever. The
crucifixion.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. But not just that, but like leading up to that as well. And so you get this chorus that's surely, surely he hath borne our griefs. And that whole chorus, the orchestra is doing these sort of almost like slash, like violent figures. This dun, 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 dun.
A lot of heavy accented notes right there.
Yeah.
Just like adding more to the powerfulness of the actual piece,
it is giving it
more drama and more oomph to it.
Yeah, yeah, and it's a bit violent, for lack of a better word. There's some pain into it, and that goes immediately into a chorus. And with his stripes, we are healed. And this is a very melodically dissonant melody. It's,
wow.
And with his stripes, it sort of leaps all over the place. It's essentially as close to atonal as Baroque music is allowed to get.
Yeah.
and sometimes
that was kind of dissonance, even back then, was kind of unheard of.
Yeah.
Compared to now.
You know, that tune, I said before that Mozart arranged Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
Mozart actually lifts the "And with his stripes" tune to use in his Requiem to get that same kind of character.
Mm-hmm.
What I find really fascinating about that chorus is that if you actually listen to the words, the message is good. "And with his stripes we are healed."
Mm-hmm.
So what Handel is doing, again, this is a sort of why this feels very accessible, is that he's not focusing on the theological point there. He's focusing on the literal pain
mm-hmm.
of getting whipped.
Ugh.
And the melody, each note is like a whip stroke.
Mm.
And so that's the part that's, again, that's, you don't have to like think really hard about what's mm-hmm. being said here. You will feel it from, you know, the first section of that melody. And what's glorious is that the next chorus, again, these are all connected,
mm-hmm.
goes to "All we like sheep have gone astray."
Mm-hmm.
And and here again is sort of the opposite situation where this is bad. We're not supposed to go astray. But again, we're not focusing on the bad part of that. We're focusing on the kind of the very tangible part of it, which mm-hmm. is that being sheep and going astray is fun. You know, so that music is very lighthearted. Mm-hmm. You know, "All we like sheep have gone astray," and the melodies are all, they go astray, like they've gone astray. They sort of go all over the place. And so when you hear those two choruses back to back, it's very much focused on the human experience of mm-hmm. those sentiments rather than the kind of theological implications, until you get to the end of "Sheep," where it's like everybody gets caught goofing off.
Oh.
And there's this very solemn, it's not very long, just maybe a half a minute or something like that, this very solemn chorus that's there to remind you, this is actually bad. but again, in the moment, you're focused on the very tangible, the very human experiences of these situations.
And can you tell us more about the concert, like what time and date the concert's actually going to be?
Sure, yeah. So we'll be Saturday night, April 30th at 7:30 at the Mansfield. It's our usual place and time. And really looking forward to getting back on stage. The orchestra actually always takes a break in March. We do mm-hmm. our February show and come back in April. So it's been a while since we've been on stage all together. So really looking forward to it. And as I say, it's something that people have gotten used to hearing around Christmas time, but it feels like a really great way to culminate our season. So I hope people come, and I think people will really enjoy it.
And let's hear snippets of highlights from Handel's Messiah. Let's listen in.
Thank you. Thank you.
Welcome back. This is KGPR Great Falls at 89.9 FM. My name is Matt Donnelly, and here in the studio with me is music director and conductor of the Great Falls Symphony, Grant Harville. Welcome back.
Thank you, Matt.
And we were talking about probably considered one of the most famous choral cantatas of all time, the Messiah by Georg Friedrich Handel.
Yep, absolutely. And one reason that I find it so inspiring is that, besides the fact that the music is incredible and all of that, it's done so much, which I think for some people is to its detriment. But for me, it connects me across countries and eras. You know, I don't know if it has the same significance to me as it did to some London audience in 1780.
Mm-hmm.
But to some extent, we're sharing that experience across time and space. And to sort of be a part of something that's been such a fixture for so long is something that I find really, there's something kind of peaceful about that, which healing or something along those lines. Anytime you can feel connected to the world around you is a good thing. And I think Messiah is one of those pieces that does that.
Especially in this time of COVID, as well as the war in Ukraine, that we're going through these uncertain times, this would be a great and very appropriate piece to perform.
Yeah,
to kind of liven up the what's been going on in times like these.
Yeah, I sometimes joke that we're always going through uncertain times. There's no such thing as a certain time.
Yeah,
but certainly I think a lot of people have been thinking the last few years about issues of connection and isolation, and I think efforts that foster connection are really important.
And again, when is the Messiah concert?
April 30th. That's a Saturday night, 7:30 at the Mansfield.
Can you tell us about future concerts that are coming up within the we're kind of going towards the last leg of this season so far.
Yeah, almost finishing things off here. Of course, our chamber music is still going strong, and people can head to our website to find some details there. After Messiah, we do have one more performance with the orchestra, kind of a special performance, and that's City Lights, the Chaplin film, where Chaplin didn't just direct an act, but he also wrote the score for that. And so we'll be doing that film with live orchestra, kind of similar to what we did with one of the Harry Potters a couple of years ago.
Wow.
So, really looking forward to that. And, one of those movies that, people who are into film talk about as kind of institution, sort of historically important and brilliant and all of that stuff. So that's coming on in on May 21st. So that'll be our actual last performance with the orchestra this year.
And do you have any closing comments about this concert or anything else?
Just great to be here again, Matt. And again, I think I'm looking forward to a really great performance with our choir and orchestra and soloists on April 30th.
Awesome. Once again, I'm here in the studio with music director and conductor of the Great Falls Symphony, Grant Harville. Thank you for coming in, Grant.
Great.
That's been fun.